Colonel Temple, real for?
Yeah. We developed, well, I developed anyway, dysentery, which becomes all too obvious. Beriberi, because your joints, particularly the ankles, swell. And jaundice, because people told me I'd gone bright yellow. And also, we were, at this point, Belsen figures. Since there were no scales, I never weighed myself, but if you've seen the films of Belsen, we were, of the Belsen survivors, we were of that ilk. Well, days passed there, and I couldn't tell you how many, until one day they decided that we were to go. This was now Lieutenant Henry Cabral, Lieutenant Eddie Leach, and myself were to go to another place. And we were taken there by truck. This turned out to be an interrogation center at a place, I've no idea really where it was, but it was some way from the mining camp. We were traveling in the truck for at least 2 hours. This was known by other prisoners as Park's Paradise because the commanding officer was a certain Major Park. When we got there, we found at least one of every nationality that was fighting for the United Nations there, at least one. Eventually, the interrogation began. Of course, the first words used, which almost became a joke, was, who started the war and why did you? So one went through that pantomime for a bit. And then they said to me, anyway, and to a number of other people, right, you know London, yes. You must know London docks. I have been there, yes. Well, in that case, you must draw us a drawing of London docks showing all the details with the colour of the roofs. I said, that's not really possible, you know. Don't forget, this business of the Geneva Convention and sort of what we should say and do had not been brought home to us. This was not known by us that you should only give number and name. Anyway, it wouldn't have meant very much because when I said, look, I'm not going to draw you a map because I can't. I was then taken outside to a little hole and had a pistol put to my head. And what do you think about drawing this map? This career officer said. They spoke, I may say, of course, in this place, perfect English, or very nearly perfect English. And I said, oh, all right, I think I will draw you a map. So I drew a map. And of course, what you had to do was to make sure that you remembered it, because having drawn the map and put in humorous little bits like Coca-Cola machine on the end of certain building, they then said the next day, ah, unfortunately, we have lost your map of London docks, so we will need you to draw it again. And, of course, if it was not identical with the drawing that you did originally, they were displeased, to say the least. It is quite incredible, to my way of thinking still, how they could be so stupid as to ask questions like that and to ask us to do drawings of London docks.
What conceivable use to them could a map of the London docks be?
I cannot imagine. But when once in a while one did see the odd Russian, only I say the odd Russian, I saw one Russian, and when we'd seen them, the questions got more intelligent. This Russian was really very strange. He was wearing a trilby, a sort of baggy suit, a shirt with a collar stud, but no collar and no tie. And I presume he was a Russian army officer of sorts. The next questions were, anyway, much more on the subject of radio equipment. Well, we had the 19 set, and that 19 set, because they were had been sent to Russia during the war as part of Help Russia. And in fact, ours had instructions in it. You know, the ones we used as Gloucesters, ours had Russian writing over the various knobs. So there was really not too much harm in telling them about the 19 set and how it was and giving a drawing and so on. Still less, nothing much harm in giving the 62 set, which was a smaller version of the 19. Probably wrong to have done that, but we didn't have a lot of guidance in this matter. Anyhow, when they came closer to things that did matter, we refused to give them the information. And then I was being interrogated by somebody who was known as the professor, who had indeed been a professor at Seoul University before the war. And oddly enough, unlike the rest of them, he was quite a gentle soul. And he said, well, I think I remember once he said, I believe we've argued long enough today. Tell me, what do you know about the strength of the Canadian Navy? And I said, as a matter of fact, I'm probably the greatest expert on the Canadian Navy of all people in the British Army. Well, how many cruisers do they have? Oh, 15. Battleships? Probably 10. And so on in this vein. And he said, that's very good, very good. And then that particular time was the end of my interrogation.
So you were deliberately exaggerating their strength?
By 1,000%, I should have thought. But anyway, then in came, several people came in at this point. One was Lieutenant Loris B. Miller of the United States Air Force. He came in. And he was dressed in an old Chinese greatcoat, which is a sort of khaki thing made out of cotton and filled with kapok. That's right. A pair of boots and a funny old sort of ragtag hat and nothing, and I mean nothing, under that because he'd been shot down. And in those days, their flying suits caught fire. They've learnt better than that now. And at that point, they decided that we should do various works outside, which was chopping down trees and bringing them in for firewood and so on and so forth. Well, I had two dropped wrists. They were like that, and I couldn't use them for anything like that. Larry Miller couldn't walk because his legs had been burnt in the fire when he was shot down. So we were put on to being cooks for this little group of about 60 of us, you know, that sort of number. We were made cooks, which meant cooking rice and a thing called a daikon, which is a sort of a large white radish-shaped turnip, something like that. And we used to have to go over to where the honchos, the honchos being the Korean interrogators, live, and get our rations from there. And there was an old Korean woman who used to do the cooking for them, and she used to give us our rations. And I used to engage her in sort of bogus conversation to detract her attention, while Larry Miller used to fill up his pockets of his greatcoat with her goodies. And she didn't seem aware of this fact at all, and we'd go away and do that. And this performance went on for about, we were cooks, I suppose, for about 3 weeks, something like that. The next thing that happened was, I remember, a South African pilot was shot down and brought in a chap called Chris Lombard, who was an Afrikaner and a very good, tough chap. His second lieutenant, but he looked much, much older. He was nearly bald, built like a tank. And it was good to see somebody who was properly built again. He clearly hadn't lost any weight at all. And one time, the Koreans came in and they signaled for me and Chris Lombard to go with them. And we thought, oh my gosh, what's happening now? And we were taken. And they said to us, right, there are these Korean sergeants, we want you to teach them English. And we said, fine. And we each were given a class in a small room, of the class of about sort of eight or so Korean sergeants. And you see, the Koreans were different from the Chinese in that they still held the view that we were British officers and had a certain rank status. Totally different from the Chinese, who took the view that we had no rank, no status, were just part of the people. And these Korean sergeants were told to obey us and all that we did during the time of the lessons. So we started giving them good capitalist propaganda. And the major, Korean major, said, and we want a report at the on all of these people that you're teaching at the end of each day. It was really quite surprising. And some of the sort of smarter Korean sergeants realized that their report increased in it was better if they gave us the odd cigarette or some kind of food. And one or two, of course, hadn't cottoned on to this and were given terrible reports as and they were taken out. It was really quite funny. One laughed for a bit. They were taken out and put in a hole for not doing what we'd said and not doing well in their language lessons, which was really quite surprising. But, of course, I suppose we overplayed our hand, because this went on for 3 days, and then they said, that's that. But it was an amusing little interlude. Came a day when they said, right, all you people are going to move out, with the exception of about eight or nine of us, something like that, i.e. about 50 people were moving out, including my best friend, Henry Cabral. And I said to the old professor, hey, we've been together all this time, how about me going in this thing? No, it's not possible. And actually, by the way, it might not be so good anywhere where they're going. So I said, well, there we are. I didn't have any choice at all, of course, none. They went on that night walking, and they walked north, and during that time, Henry Cabral died of dysentery, which I didn't know until much, much later when I joined other people. By this time, well, a few weeks later, the peace talks had started on the line, because they certainly hadn't finished. And one night it was decided, pack your everything, they used to say, which actually meant in my case just standing up, because I didn't have anything. And we went on. Now, unfortunately, there was this American colonel called Fowler, Hugh Fowler, and he was so ill that it was decreed that we should carry him in a gunny sack, well, a rice bag between two poles. And so we did. But Chris Lombard, being fitter by far, he took one end completely himself, and he took it in turns on the other end, each carrying one pole rather than two. And so we walked through that night. I don't know how many miles it was, but it seemed to go on forever, until we arrived at this place, which was later known as Traitor's Row amongst the POW fraternity. Traitor's Row, because it was from here that the people who had collaborated with the Chinese had all assembled there somehow. And they were the people like well, certain people who'd collaborated and made broadcasts. There were these people who'd collaborated and broadcast anti-capitalist propaganda to their own side. What we did notice straight away was that the standard of food and accommodation was way in excess of what we had previously been accustomed to. I mean, it was good food, and the accommodation was warm. What I should have said a lot earlier was that, again, one other person came into the camp one day. He was this chap, Sergeant George Murat. When I first saw him, I thought, my gosh, he is about 70, because his hair was white, what there was of it, and his face was a terrible mess. Again, he was a chap who had been burnt when he was shot down, and his flying suit had caught fire and his hair had caught fire, and the resultant hair growth, such as it was white. However, he turned out to be one of the few tough Americans. His history was that he had worked in an abattoir in Chicago before joining the American Air Force. And eventually, after some weeks, it occurred to me, this was after the column had moved out, that he and I should chum up, because at this point, situation was getting bad, and we were starting to bury quite a few people. There was one ranger captain we buried. He died of plain give-up-itis, no doubt about it. Anyhow, George Murat and I made a little pact. This was when we were down to about 10 or 12 of us. And we said to each other, our pact was that we would look after the others as best we could, but when it came to one of us going down and getting even iller than we were, we would pull out all the stops. Well, we didn't have to do this, and we did look after the other people, but I have to say I looked after 10 people, and I must be the only male nurse that's had 100% fatalities, to my credit, because they all died.
From and lack of morale?
Partly that. I mean, it was lack of morale, lack of guts. You could say it was, I mean, dysentery does take the stuffing right out of you, indeed. No doubt about it. In fact, there was even one British Marine who died of that, but there was no doubt he had worse dysentery than anybody else. Marine Bishop, I remember his name was, and we buried him. Yeah. There was also a French adjudant. He was there too, Fabien Felice. And we got bad go of dysentery on the same day. And I the sort of lavatory place, which was a ditch really, was just outside the compound. But there was only one person allowed outside the compound at the same at any one time. And I suppose we went that day to this lavatory, I would think, each 40 times, not less. A debilitating experience, but I always remember him saying, "Mon lieutenant, dépêchez-vous," and he would come galloping out and I would come in again, and so it went on throughout the day. But that was Fabien Felice. French, good, no problem there. And there was a Belgian there, Gobert. He unfortunately got weaker and weaker, and he died. And so when we went left for what we subsequently found or called Traitor's Row, we were a very small amount. Well, we got there, and at that point, people said to us, "Right, you're all going to be released." So we said, "Oh, well, that's all right then." And we thought we could somehow escape being mixed in with these, well, traitors, yes, no other word for it, for a few days while this was going on. And then the peace talks came to nothing. We then were taken by truck right up to the Yalu River. This time, this was now winter of, yes, I suppose it was January 52, something like that. January 52. We were taken up to a camp on the Yalu River. This turned out to be where they had the other ranks of both Britain and America and all the other nationalities. We were kept in slightly separate hut. But what was good to show how superior the British army discipline and thinking was to other people, it was quite interesting that the senior other rank of each of the units all made it their business to escape from there where they were in their places of living and come and report to me as soon as they'd heard, and they did it unknown to the guards, and somebody from the 8th Hussars, somebody from the Gloucesters, somebody from Northumberland Fusiliers, somebody from the Gunners, and they all said what their situation was, who was there, who was alive, who wasn't, and so on. Actually, I couldn't write it all down, but I did remember some of it. Stayed there one night before taken on to what was known as Camp 2. And there, for the first time since being captured, i.e. since April till January, I was in what could be thought to be something like a prisoner of war camp. Once again, it was actually another schoolhouse. And here I met up with a number of other people who I'd known before, at Gloucesters, etc. Well, fortunately, at this time, they had stopped the indoctrination. Apparently, before we arrived there, they had indoctrination lessons in communism, etc., etc. I actually missed all that. That had been, well, I think they thought it was a poor idea and getting nowhere eventually. And then came the second summer, and we were in this place. At this point, I may say, I still had wrist drop. It was just getting right, but I was still apparently very, very thin, and well, not too well. But gradually, during the summer, recovered, and gradually was able to eat a bit more and find some more to eat, and also to take exercise, which was really important. And what was quite pleasant was every so often we had to go down to the Yalu River. I suppose it was a distance of about 4 to 5 miles from where we were on the camp. And there, these ships would tie up alongside, and we used to unload their loads of timber and then bring it back to the camp, each man carrying a couple of logs each, which of course may sound not very economical proposition, but that's how it was. And when you have 200 people carrying two logs, you end up with 400 logs, so it's, you know, not bad. We did that, and that really became a very pleasant little chore. It wasn't a chore at all. It was a nice walk out in the country with the sun shining and so on, pleasant. As the following winter came, so conditions improved altogether. We even got a change of clothing, which was something, because at that time I was down to really nothing of my own British Army clothing. We got these, what the Chinese issued us, which was a blue jacket, blue trousers, and a pair of gym shoes. And that was fun. And fine, that was in the summer. And then in the winter, got the same thing, only this time the jacket was, and trousers were padded with this kapok stuff. And they were adequate, really quite adequate, against the Korean winter, which was quite chilly. During that winter, what happened? Oh yes, a number of people suffered from night blindness, or even unable to read the printed word. Not that there was a lot to read, except every so often we got a copy of the Shanghai News, which was, of course, an English language communist newspaper, which gave a pretty garbled view of the conduct of the war and everything else, but one picked up something from it. And then